This lecture, entitled The Court Jews, Their Wealth and Influence, is dedicated to the honor and merit of Dr. and Mrs. Paul and Miri Zeidel and their children. A story is told about the famous international financier, John Pierpont Morgan, or J.P. Morgan, who, after testifying in front of a select committee of Congress, was asked by one of the congressmen if he knew what direction the stock market would be taking in the near future. Mr. Morgan replied that, in fact, he did. As the committee men leaned forward to catch every word from the mouth of one of America's most successful investors, Mr. Morgan told them, "It will fluctuate." In a similar sense, human history in general, and Jewish history in particular, is in a continuous state of flux. With one upheaval, either political, economic, or ideological, leading in turn to other numerous and significant changes. In the last lectures, we discussed the state of the Jewish communities as they existed throughout much of the Middle Ages and through the period known as the pre-modern era, a period that witnessed the Renaissance in Italy, Protestant reform in Germany, Switzerland, and England, terrible wars throughout all of Europe, and the rise of mercantilism and absolutist regimes, economic and political changes that we will explain further on in this lecture. Towards the end of this era, through the influence of the Enlightenment philosophers, thinkers, subtle changes occurred within the outlook of the general populace that eventually led to the massive upheavals, both political and spiritual, that were experienced in the modern era. These subtle changes will be touched upon in this and in the following lecture. In Europe, during the Middle Ages, the church had inordinate power. As a result, the Jews, killers of the Christian God, who continued to refuse to accept the great love offered to them by the church, suffered terribly. In previous lectures, we've covered many of the mass murders that occurred in Germany from the time of the Crusades up until the end of the Middle Ages. In addition, during the 15th and 16th centuries, Jews were expelled from most of the commercial centers and larger territories within the German, or as it was known, Holy Roman Empire. Although Jews were allowed to settle in some large cities, such as Frankfurt, Worms, Fürth, Halberstadt, Prague, and Vienna, for the most part, however, during this period, Jews lived in smaller communities. These small, mostly rural communities, as well as similar communities within Poland, were organized in the so-called Landjudenschaften, or Jewish provincial communities. Even later on, when the Jews were given the permission to move back to the larger communities, most of the kahila, the community, continued to live in the outlying areas. For instance, when Jews were finally allowed to settle in Würzburg, Bavaria, in 1814, after some 250 years of exile, of exclusion, their first chief rabbi was Harav HaGoyen Rav Avrom Bing. In his position, he was also in charge of close to 100 outlying small towns and hamlets, all part of the general kahila community of Würzburg. So it wasn't just Würzburg, it was a whole stretch for miles and miles. By the way, Rav Avrom Bing, a disciple, Talmud of the fame of Nosson Adler, was amongst the greatest of the Rabbon and rabbinic authorities and Rosh Yeshiva, heads of yeshiva of the early 18th century. Among his most famous disciples were Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, the famed Rav of Altona, and the author of the Oroch LeNer and Shuvas Binyan Tzion, Rav Isaac Bernays, the Rav of Hamburg. These two aforementioned giants of spirit and learning, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger and Rav Isaac Bernays, were jointly the Rebbeim mentors of Rav Shamsher Fol Hirsch, as well as Rav Azriel Hildesheimer, the two men most responsible for the renaissance of Orthodox Judaism in Germany during the 19th century. Rav Avraham Bing was also the Rebbe of his famed successor as Rav of Würzburg, the great halachic authority Rav Yitzchak Dov Bamberger. Now, during this period, especially before the mid-17th century, Jews were generally limited as to the means that the government let them conduct business. They were allowed to lend money on interest, something forbidden by canon law for Christians. They were also allowed to be involved in international trade, mostly between Poland and Germany, as well as peddling to the small outlying communities of Germany and Poland. Now, each Jewish community, in order to ensure their own economic viability, limited competition from Jews who came from other communities. This is all based on Talmudic law. The following passage, taken from the Hagoyas HaRamah, the glosses of the Ramosha Israelish, to Shulchan Aruch Hosha Mishpat, Simen Kufnen Nun Vov Siv Zion, gives us a further glimpse as to the nature of the communities as they existed during this period. And that's on the first page of your notes after. This is taken from the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch. In a dangerous situation where members of a city fled to an outlying rural community, as long as a danger still persists, the members of that rural community cannot prevent the refugees from conducting business in a manner sufficient for them to earn a livelihood. To the extent of their meager business revenue, they are required to share in the financial burden of the rural community. Although they are still taxpayers in the principal city, the city from which they fled, the rural community cannot prevent them from earning a living. Similarly, in a situation where the members of a city wish to expel someone from the city, as he has no rights of residence, and we've discussed this in the previous lecture, that rights of residence were really limited by the host government. The Jews were really limited in terms of how many Jews could be in a community. And they had to really have to be issued official rights of residence. So this person has no rights of residence. They cannot do so until he is able to collect all his debts. In other words, if they expelled him, at least he's able, he has to stay there until he's able to collect his debts and then go on his way and find another community. During the interim, he can conduct business sufficient for him to earn a livelihood. There are those that maintain that the ruling of the person who has fled is required to pay taxes only in proportion to his temporary income. It was only stated in the case where the rural community does not wish to grant him a residency permit. If they are willing, however, to grant him such a permit, then the person is required to either immediately pay the full amount of community taxes or to leave and go on his way. This is one opinion. There are those that disagree with this ruling. In other words, since he's really, he really does not want to live here, and he's really forced to live here, even though the community is willing to grant him residency, but it's really under duress, he still has the right just to be here to survive, so to speak. In a situation where members of one city conduct business in another city. So the first situation was he was forced to leave. There was some situation where he was forced to leave, and he's only in the other city temporarily. Here's another situation. In a situation where members of one city conduct business in another city, the city where the business is conducted cannot force those people to pay the full amount of taxes as they would normally desire. That's because they don't really live in the city. They just visit the city to conduct business. They can tell them, however, that they either should pay the city a specific amount in taxes or be denied their rights to trade within the city. That much they can control. He continues on, if they desire to settle in that city, the people, and pay the full amount of taxes equal to any other community member, there are those, and again, he's just listing different rabbinic opinions. There are those that maintain that anyone has the right to move wherever he so desires and the original settlers of that community have no right to stop him. That's one opinion. There are others that disagree, however, and say that the original members of the community do have the rights to prevent someone from moving in, especially presently that we live under foreign domination, and there is reason to fear that if the population increases, the Gentiles will cause damage to the community. Therefore, one who comes to settle a community has the status of a rodef, a pursuer. Consequently, if the members of the city can figuratively lock the door, the range of the ruling power's protest against someone moving in, or through some other means, they have the right to do so. Now, just as a parallel to this question, and I was just reading a recently written article about the status of the Jews who wanted to flee, you know, European countries and come to America. Well, the United States had very strict immigration policies that had already they had instituted from the mid-1920s. 90% of the American populace did not want to relax those limits, even in the situation where the Jews were forced to leave and their lives were in danger. They still did not want to relax the immigration. But it seems that 25% of the Jews in America did not want these guidelines relaxed either. They were afraid if more Jews would come in, especially immigrants, it would cause additional anti-Semitism. So just, it's interesting, the parallel. Yeah. There are places where the custom is, the community can impose the refusal of rights of residency. Through a cherem, in other words, we basically say you cannot live here, and if you continue to live here, you will be put under a ban. We discussed at length the previous lecture about the guidelines of a cherem. In such a situation, they can force one to leave the community. Even though such powers may not be normally afforded to them by Talmudic law, the community has also the power to decree that no one is allowed to do business with those who come to settle without permission. If there is a rov in the city, he can decree that the city must allow a specific person to move to the city, provided that the person is a disciple of the rov. As they wanted to encourage Talmid HaChachamim, this is the scholars or the students of the Rav, to come to the community to enhance the spiritual level of community. There are those who say that the cherem ban regarding permission of settlement does not apply to a Talmid Chacham, for he can live wherever he so chooses. And thus it's not limited to someone who is a disciple of the Rav, of the rabbi of the city, but any Talmud Chacham has the right to move to a city, and the city has no right to stop him. And he continues on, it was the custom of the earlier generations that a person loses his rights of residence if he left the city for a period of 12 months and indicated that at the time that he had made the decision not to return. If, however, he indicated he was planning to return, he does not lose his rights of residence even after 3 years. There are those that maintain that even when he made no indication at all, he still does not lose his rights of residence. So the rights of residence was really a very difficult issue. But underlying this whole question of rights of residence was that the host government really reluctantly accepted the Jews. And they were always afraid of being too liberal on one hand. And on the other hand, there was the fear of competition. So they had both things in mind. In this passage from the Shulchan Aruch, we get a glimpse into the conditions that existed then and the dangers the Jews experienced during this period. We start off with the incident of those who fled because of danger, as well as the danger of overpopulation that could possibly lead to terrible consequences by the Gentile authorities and populace, and the difficulties of maintaining a delicate balance between the rights of the individual versus the rights of the community. We also see from this passage the revered and special place of Talmidei Chachamim, Torah scholars within Jewish life in that period. Often, because of the dangers that existed then, Far-flung communities were forced to band together and join forces for mutual protection. Their only protection, besides the power of prayer, was to raise enough money to bribe the Gentile authorities in order that they let them remain in peace within their communities. The following tshuva response from Rabbi Yosef Cologne, the leading authority of Jewry in northern Italy during the end of the 15th century, gives a further appreciation of dynamics of community life during this period. Here is on page 2, the bottom, paragraph B. In my humble opinion, it appears to me that all of the communities that are certainly in the path of danger, literally are about to drink the poisonous cup, if the matter is not taken care of to the extent possible, are required to shoulder the burden of rescuing the holy community of Regensburg, for it is their rescue as well. If Regensburg is not rescued, God forbid, the opposite will be true. Even though at this time they're only libeling the holy community of Regensburg, eventually the tragedy will affect them as well, and they are to be considered equally in danger and are required to help with the expenses of averting the tragedy by saving the holy community of Regensburg. May the Rock and Redeemer protect them. It is not clear what their specific concern was, I mean, from the response. But during this period, Jews were subject to the infamous blood libel, the claim that Jews killed Christians in order to use their blood on Passover, as well as the libel that Jews would steal the quote-unquote host, the wafer used in the Eucharist, the Christian Mass, which the members of the Catholic Church, based upon their doctrine of transubstantiation, believed to be the actual flesh of their God and Redeemer. In other words, during the Mass, during the Eucharist, notice that they dip a wafer in wine and put it into the and give it into the to the worshiper. This is what the priest does. In other Christian sects and then Protestant sects, they view this as a symbol. The wafer is the flesh of Yeshu, and the wine is his blood. The Catholic Church believed in transubstantiation, that actually is he comes within the wafer and he comes within the wine. The populace believed that the Jews would steal the quote-unquote host in order to have the opportunity to once again abuse Yeshu, who is now reincarnated in the host. As an expression of the hatred that the Jews harbored towards Yeshu and all his followers. This incredible libel was a subject of untold, was a cause of untold suffering for the Jewish people during the Middle Ages. And we continue on. Because the city of Nuremberg, as well as the other cities in Germany, are not allowed to issue a written decree due to their fear of the various governmental authorities or for whatever reason. I, the unworthy one, am coming, the youth, am coming to strengthen their words, even though their words really don't need any strengthening. I hereby decree upon all the residents of Germany, man, woman, and child, individual and groups, not to disobey my masters who have assembled in Nuremberg, and pay all that has been levied upon each and every community, individuals or groups, to assist with the costs involved with this vile libel, which they have insidiously spread against our brethren in the holy community of Regensburg. Everyone is required to pay the exact amount which has been levied upon them by our rabbis. They shouldn't refuse or resist. Another tshuva, so it gives you again a sense of what Jewish life was. Another tshuva from that period, this from Yoar Chaim Bachrach, one of the leading rabbonim of Germany in the late 17th century, gives us a further insight into the life and struggles of that period, especially in smaller communities. This is in the bottom of page 3. The following incident occurred in a village made up of 13 householders, Balabatim. They had designated an appropriate room as a synagogue in which they prayed in a minyan on a daily basis. When the Yomim Noroyim, in the days of awe, arrived, the nearest capable Baltakeya, expert shofar blower, lived at a distance of 6 parsangs, 6 parses, which is approximately 13 and a half miles. Because of the danger involved in travel at that time, because of the wartime conditions that then existed, he was only willing to come if he was to be prepaid a sum of 20 Reichstaler, as he was afraid that otherwise they might renege on their promise and only give what they normally give him, i.e. 6 Reichstaler. The aforementioned householders met together to decide whether to give him the amount that he requested. 6 of them argue that they pay the Baltakeya the amount that he requested, so they'll be able to fulfill their responsibilities on the Yomim Noroyim. 7 of them, however, argued they have no wish to spend so much of their money for this purpose, as they were poor people and it was beyond their means. The 6 argued that the 7 had no right to outvote them, even though they were the majority, as the 6 represented the bulk of the support of the community. They also argued that following the majority would contradict the verse. This is their own novel interpretation. You shall not follow a multitude to do evil. For it certainly would be evil and bitter to forsake the great mitzvah that only comes once a year. The simple meaning of the text, I mean, there's different drushas, there's different homiletic explanations, but the simple meaning of the text is that if you are in a Sanhedrin, you're in a court where each judge is voting. You should vote your conscience, even though the others want to condemn this person. You are the lone or one of the lone supporters that he should be vindicated. You should not withhold your vote and just be swayed and go by the majority. Don't go after the majority to do bad, what you feel is wrong. You have to express your own vote. That's the simple meaning of the text. But this novel interpretation is, when it comes to do bad things, you don't vote with the majority. All of them came before their Malamed, the teacher of school-aged children, who was referred to by them as Rabbi. With great confidence and quote-unquote authority, he told them that he had just studied the very same law in a Mishnah in Peah with his students. It is stated in Peah, this is the beginning of the 4th chapter, even if 99 of the poor urge distribution of the Peah by the owner of the field, and one only is in favor of competitive grabbing, the latter is listened to since his claim is in accordance with the halacha. So too, he continued, we listen to the voice of the 6, even if only one of them would voice such an opinion, he who argues otherwise is making an error against a Mishnaic ruling. Now, it is evident that there's no comparison between the two cases. Torah law entitles every poor person to take on his own from the produce set aside as peah, this is from the corner of the field, and is not required to have it equally apportioned and to share it with others. The poor man who wishes to take as much as he can by himself cannot be forced to relinquish his rights, even in the face of the majority of the other poor. That's the mission, because he has his rights. If every single one of them decides to relinquish their rights, okay, they relinquish their rights. But otherwise, he has the right to take. He feels he could take, and he doesn't want to give up his portion. We have no right to force him. That's the Mishnah. In this case, however, the 7 members are arguing that they are not bound by the decision of the minority. This is the poor people, the 7 people. And hence are not required to pay for the Baltakeya. So they have the right to do so. I mean, it's a communal decision. They are the majority. And we continue on. Sometime later, I heard that they followed the words of their rabbi as if they had received it at Mount Sinai. It was told to me that those 6 whom the fear of God had touched their hearts agreed that if the others would stubbornly refuse to pay their share, then they alone would pay the Baal Tekeh his fee, and they would make a stipulation with him that he only have in mind to blow the shofar on their behalf and not on behalf of the others. You know, as it was, though, they listened to their quote-unquote rabbi. I wrote a letter to the quote-unquote rabbi containing many terrible curses. As it came to my attention through this incident, they had made many erroneous rulings. In order that he not complain against my interference, I wrote to him, explained to him that the Mishnah has no relevance in this case. And it continues on, if the majority of the community were poor, even if some of them would agree that the community spend the money, those who refuse are in the right. For in such a case, we follow that which is dictated by the halakha and not by their personal decisions. Because the majority, that's a community, it's a community council. I mean, the community comes together. The majority had voted in one way, not to pay. Even if the amount collected would be in accordance with their personal worth, in other words, it would be a sliding scale, nonetheless, the poor person is not required to spend even a little more than is required due to his dire circumstances. Now, despite the firm commitment to the observance of Torah and mitzvahs by such villagers, due to their limited resources, there was often a dearth of scholarship in these communities. As is evident from this citation, there was often a disparity of income amongst the members of the community, the wealthier members carrying the lion's share of the financial burden. The existence of diversity within each community is as old as the Jewish people themselves. As we read here, they're on page 4. This is taken from a Gemara in Chulin in Sadi Bezo Medalef in 92a. Rav Shimon ben Lokesh said, this is regarding the interpretation of the dream of the Sar HaMashkim, the butler, the one who poured the wine for Pharaoh. And he had the dream of the three branches and the grapes, and he squeezed the grapes into the cup and provided wine for Pharaoh. So there was one level of interpretation, of course, that affected the butler. There was another interpretation, as this was the dream that, in a sense, released Yosef, brought him fame and fortune and power, and brought about the eventual exile of his whole family and the whole Egyptian exile. This was a dream that affected the Jewish people. And it's understood on that level that there was another level of interpretation of that dream, not just for the Sar HaMashkin, for the butler. And that's a discussion, the Gemara in Chulin Sadi Beis, what is that, the universal, the greater interpretation. Reish Lakish, Shimon ben Lakish, explains as follows. This people, Israel, are compared to a vine. And it brings there's a verse in Tehillim. Gefen Mitzrayim Tasiya, it's referring to the vine of Israel moving out of Egypt. So the people are compared to a vine. Its branches are the aristocracy. Its clusters, this is of the grapes, the scholars. Its leaves, the common people. Its twigs or knots, those in Israel that are void of learning. This is what was meant when word was sent from there, from Palestine, to Babylon. They said, let the clusters pray for the leaves. For were it not for the leaves, the common people, the clusters could not exist. The scholars are an outgrowth of the community as a whole. And the community as a whole supports the scholars. Says the scholars should pray on behalf of the whole general community. But we see that there is a diversity within the community. There's a diversity in terms of wealth. And there's diversity on another level as well. This is learning, good deeds. And we find on page 5 here. This is from the Medrash's Siktad Rav Kahana. And when there's a symbolism here. He shall take on the first day the fruit of the Hadar tree. Creates other, the Esrit. That is an allusion to Yisrael, the Jewish people. Just like the Esrog has a pleasant fragrance and is nourishing, so too Yisrael contains within it those who are masters of Torah and have performed good deeds. The tight frond of a palm tree is allusion to Yisrael. Just as the palm tree has nutritious food but does not possess a fragrance, so too there are those of Yisrael who are masters of Torah but do not perform good deeds. The branch of the myrtle, the Eitz Ovos tree, this is the Hodos, is an allusion to Yisrael. Just as the myrtle has a fragrance but does not contain food, so too there are those amongst Yisrael who have performed good deeds but do not possess Torah. The willows of the brook alludes to Yisrael, just like the willow who possesses neither taste nor fragrance. So too are there members of Yisrael who are neither masters of Torah nor perform good deeds. The Holy One, blessed be He, said, to destroy them is impossible. But that they should all join together as a single group. One will atone for the other. One will have an influence on the other. Consequently, Moshe admonished Yisrael and said to them, you shall take on the first day all four species together. Is really that the community as a whole, when they come together, each one has a positive influence on the other. But again, this is early on, really represents, there was a diversity within the community. Because there are different segments of it, just like every individual is different, but there are different segments of the community. As we see from the following citation, the status of wealth, in contrast with the status of learning and good deeds, was often ephemeral. As we now read, here, this is on C. Reb Chiya said to his wife, when a poor man comes, be quick to offer him bread. This is from the Gemara in Shabbos, Kufnan Aleph on Beis, 151b. So that others may be quick to offer it to your children. That's what he told his wife. You curse them, she exclaimed. And his reply is, a verse is written, he replied. Because, this is Biglal Adavra Zeh, because that, Biglal for this thing, this is about giving charity. Whereupon the school of Rabbi Shmuel taught why that word is used, Biglal, it is a wheel, a galgal, that revolves in the world. Poverty is a wheel of fortune. Those who are wealthy in this generation, not necessarily wealthy in the next generation. So he says, treat the poor with respect. Be quick to give them their needs are felt, they're taken care of. Because in the inevitable, what he views was that inevitably will come, so the wheel will now turn, at least that when the poverty will affect them, it will be done in a compassionate way. Just as you've treated the people that you are sharing your wealth with compassion. But it was a certain sense of inevitability. History attests to this phenomenon. In the following true response of Chacham Tzvi, one of the leading authorities in Europe during the early 18th century. A nobleman requested a loan from his Jewish subjects on condition that he pay it back in a year or two. They responded to his request and lent him a specific sum. Each one of his subjects contributed towards this sum in accordance with their estimated wealth. At the time when the loan became due and the representatives of the community came to him to collect their debt, the nobleman berated them and rudely ejected them from his palace. Subsequently, a considerable time passed, and the members of the community had despaired of recovering their loans, for who can bring to justice someone more powerful than he? In the interim, the affluent members of the community expended much of their personal wealth towards this loan, had fallen on hard times, and lost all their wealth. While many poor people had become wealthy, as is typical of the turning wheel of fortune. In the course of this long time period, the nobleman died and his son inherited his position. Taking pity upon his Jewish subjects and being sensitive to the reputation of his deceased father, as one who borrowed and didn't repay. He called a meeting of his Jewish subjects and told them that he was going to pay back that loan by reducing the amount of the various taxes that, they are required to pay him every year. Please guide us, our master. Who merits this repayment of that loan? Is it the former men of wealth who now are destitute, since that money originally came from their pockets? Or is those that are presently wealthy, even though they didn't contribute towards the loan, it's they that should merit this form of payment, since the original owners of the loan are already despaired of ever being repaid? In other words, they've given up the problem is yeish. In other words, you give up hope. Just a person gives up hope of a lost object, for instance. He lost something, he gives up hope, violates the soaring keys, he says, I'll never see this again. Someone else picks it up, he can keep it. What about a loan? The answer, such a thing was already asked of the Ma'arik, which we quoted before on a different subject, Rav Yosef Kalon, Sponsum 3, who responded that the present men of wealth are those who should benefit from this. He elaborated on the subject and Yisrael Israelin quotes his opinion in chapter 163 without quoting a dissenting opinion. They basically, the argument is, well, they gave up hope, so therefore they have no rights to reclaim this loan. And therefore, he's just giving a gift to the city. Well, he's giving us a gift to the city. Therefore, it's a reduction of taxes. So whoever pays the taxes now, it's reduced by a third, so everyone just pays a third less.
So they never given up the hope, then that's would have been different.
Right. I disagree with the Ma'arik and Yisrael Israelin. This is the Chacham Tzvi is saying. And he continues on, therefore it seems to me, because he has a long, intellectual, a legal discussion of the issue, that those men of wealth who originally lent their money to the nobleman are entitled to be repaid, each according to the amount that he was assessed. In other words, that the laws of Yeish don't apply over here. But again, this all gives you a sense of what life was during this period. Now, although affluence has always played a special role in community life, especially during the period of the general impoverished conditions of Jewry in the Middle Ages, there were relatively very few people then who possessed real wealth and influence. During the 100 years between the mid-17th and 18th century, however, the general material situation of Jewry radically improved. Historians trace much of this change to the results of the so-called 30 Years' War. Although it began as a religious war, a struggle between the Protestants and Catholics of Western and Central Europe, involving Catholic Austria, Bavaria, Poland, and Spain, against Protestant Bohemia, the Palatinate, Netherlands, Denmark, and Sweden, eventually the war spilled over beyond religious boundaries with Catholic France in conjunction with the Protestant Netherlands, Sweden, and some Protestant German princes fighting against Catholic Spain and Austria for hegemony of Western Europe. After 30 years of fighting, which killed at least half of the civilian populations of Brandenburg, Mecklenburg, Pomerania, the Palatinate, Württemberg, and parts of Bavaria, a peace treaty was signed in Westphalia, forever changing the map of Europe. In January 1648, Spain and the Netherlands made peace, formally recognizing Dutch independence. On October 24, 1648, the other treaties were signed. The Holy Roman Emperor Ferdinand III, whose mainly Catholic empire began the conflict, was forced to cede much of his power as the various German princes obtained formal right to wage war and conduct negotiations, make alliances and choose their religion for themselves and their subjects, leaving the emperor with few powers. All in all, 240 territories of various sizes that comprise the Holy Roman Empire now receive full liberty and sovereignty. But after 30 years of continuous conflict, these semi-independent territories were depopulated, impoverished, their monetary system in shambles, and trade with foreign territories altogether disrupted. In the midst of all of this, there had developed a new political philosophy and economic system in France that was imitated by virtually all of the various German political entities during the aftermath of this conflict. During the Middle Ages, the powers of the state were divided amongst the various subgroups: the king, the landed gentry or noblemen, the church, which owned vast estates and wielded inordinate power, the independent cities, and the guilds, whose craftsmen and merchants controlled the economy. The Jews, of course, were barely tolerated, living on the fringes of society, and were considered to be aliens or foreigners. Now, this new political philosophy, called absolutism, viewed the previous medieval system as being too cumbersome and inefficient. The supposition was that if all political and economic power would be held solely in the hands of the prince or monarch, not in the hands of the various religious, aristocratic or corporate groups which had previously held power, the state would act in a coordinated and focused manner to the benefit of all of its citizens. Consequently, the various princes and monarchs began what became to be viewed as an internal war within their respective territories, limiting the powers of the various religious, cultural, and economic groups and consolidating them into a unified state under a single authority who would now embody the very essence of the state, which was the king or the duke. In this new scheme of things, these various potentates viewed the Jews, who had never before wielded any power, as useful allies in their struggle to undermine the many diverse powers of the old regime. During this new era, from the mid-17th to the mid-18th century, Jews were now invited to resettle in cities and hold territories from where they had been previously expelled. In addition, a new economic philosophy called mercantilism was developed in conjunction with absolutism. The focus of this economic philosophy was again not on the welfare of the individual, but on the state. It assumed that an independent state is in a constant economic war with other states. In order to survive, it must amass more wealth than its competitors. Amassing wealth meant amassing as much gold, silver, and other precious metals from customers abroad, increasing exports and limiting costly imports. The government thus encouraged domestic industry, the ultimate source of exports, regulated production, controlled trading companies, and sought out raw materials and markets through colonialism. The exportation of raw materials that could be used by a competing state was banned, and the importation of finished goods, which would deplete the monetary reserves of the country, was discouraged. That's where there were tariffs. This was all based upon the now discredited assumption that the total volume of international trade was limited and that countries could expand their trade only at the expense of others. As a result, increasing the number of inhabitants through immigration was encouraged, as more people would generate more wealth for the state through their productive activities. In addition, the monetary and financial systems were reorganized, and aid was offered to anyone who was in a position to add to the state's wealth: the merchant, tradesman, manufacturer, and banker. In this new world, the Jew had finally found a place. Trade and lending money on interest, once condemned in the Middle Ages, was now encouraged. It only made sense to them that if a state wanted to flourish, it should encourage Jews to settle there and devote their talents and connections to furthering their financial and commercial activity. The newly empowered princes needed capable and experienced financiers to procure for them the sums of money which they needed to wage war, maintain an army, a bureaucracy, and a royal court. And unlike the Gentile financiers of the past, the Jewish financiers didn't need to be paid with vast land holdings or royal titles. These court Jews or Hofjuden, men of wealth and influence who acted as close confidants for virtually every single German prince, provided their employers with expertise in finance, diplomacy, commerce, and politics, at relatively very little cost to them. Since Jews in the Middle Ages were not allowed to own land, all of their accumulated wealth was relatively liquid, ready to be of service to the state in this new world order. Of course, as we just pointed out before, wealth is not permanent. And most of these wealthy court Jews eventually experienced a change of fortune, if not in their own lifetimes, in the lifetimes of their heirs. But this newfound wealth often came at a cost. Although the vast majority of these court Jews were pious and used their wealth and influence to help other needy Jews, as well as to provide employment for numerous others, they and their children after them were no longer strangers to the non-Jewish world about them, and developed a familiarity with the culture and language of their host states, a familiarity that would eventually have a profound effect upon their progeny. This will be, Amir Tzashem, touched upon in the coming lecture. In the remainder of this lecture, I would like to focus upon the lives of some of the most famous of the court Jews. Shmuel Oppenheimer, Shimshon Wertheimer, Beran Lehman, and Yosef Zis Oppenheimer. Each, in his own way, typified the life of a court Jew, their contribution toward the financial and political success of their employers, their intercession on behalf of their co-religionists, and their own personal success and often failure in bankruptcy. Of the roles that the various court Jews played, perhaps the most difficult and precarious was that of being a military supplier or war commissary to the prince or king. Even after obtaining sufficient armaments or food for the soldiers on credit, if that was possible, delivery of these goods to the military was often out of the question because of unsafe roads. Goods were frequently plundered by soldiers, and wares were often spoiled during the long journey from one country to the next or from one front to the next. In addition, the military supplier was more often than not the scapegoat for the mistakes of the generals, the failure of the state bureaucracy, or the depletion of the state treasury. If the soldiers were given poor food, insufficient pay, or inferior equipment, it was the military supplier that was blamed. If the harvest was poor and the peasants didn't have enough to eat, the military supplier was blamed because of the large grain purchases he had made on behalf of the army. If a general was defeated in battle, the defeat was attributed to the military supplier for not having supplied sufficient food or munitions on time. But at a time when few options were open to Jews, supplying the military did offer a unique opportunity for them, as they were uniquely qualified for the position due to their unparalleled ability to create a network of their fellow Jews who would be now given the opportunity to help them. For example, Jews who lived in Poland, Russia, or Lithuania could buy vast amounts of produce indispensable to the military forces of one or another of the German states in their countries, deliver them to the military suppliers at the fairs of Breslau and Leipzig, where Jews of the East met their counterparts of the West. In addition, the many Jews throughout the villages of the German Empire were enlisted as military supplier agents to obtain various necessary foodstuffs and send it to him, the military supplier. Probably the most famous and dedicated of all of the military suppliers was Samuel or Shmuel Oppenheimer. He came from an old and respected Frankfurt family and originally was a financial agent and military supplier to Elector Karl Ludwig of Platz, the Palatinate in southern Germany. We mentioned him before in a previous lecture. Eventually, Oppenheimer became the chief army supplier for the Holy Roman Emperor Leopold I. Leopold reigned from 1658 to 1705. I like to quote from Selma Stern's work, The Court Jew, describing Shmuel Oppenheimer's activities in the year 1683, when the Ottoman Turks, led by Grand Vizier Kara Mustafa Pasha, overran the Austrian territories and laid siege to Vienna. Quote, Oppenheimer was able to deliver immediately after signing of the contract 80,000 hundredweights of flour to the garrison at Linz, but had to work day and night to obtain as great a quantity of oats as possible so that the cavalry might not be endangered by a lack of fodder. You know, it's interesting. When you think about the military, you just think normally about the soldiers. Speak about the generals, the strategy. But the famous dictum, the famous phrase, an army marches on its stomach, is really true. And we continue. When after the liberation of Vienna, the Austrian imperial troops began to pursue the fleeing enemy, Oppenheimer arranged to have hand grenades, gunpowder, pistols, and carbines sent on ships and rafts down the Danube and by means of wagons and horses on the roads. At the same time, he secured rafts to move troops from the empire, transported an army from Hungary to Krakow, transferred cavalry regiments from Brunswick to Bohemia, and supplied all the fortresses in Hungary, Albania, Transylvania, and Serbia. His chief problem, his problems were besieged often, whose army had to be supplied with provisions, munitions, clothing, tobacco, linen, and brandy. And newly conquered Belgrade, to which he sent 100 large ships, hospital, and camp equipment and materials for shipbuilding. End quote. Leopold, a devout Catholic, who previously had cruelly expelled all the Jews from Vienna in the year 1670, was forced to openly admit that Oppenheimer had always served him faithfully, that he was a reliable military contractor, and that the army would have been lost without him. Despite all of this, there were constant attempts within Leopold's administration to discredit Oppenheimer and to remove him from office, especially Cardinal Kalinich, the president of the Department of Finance and the one directly responsible for the Jews being expelled from Vienna. In addition, the state was terribly delinquent in paying Schmuel Oppenheimer his debts. In 1694, the Austrian state debt to Schmuel Oppenheimer was 3 million florins, or gold dollars, an enormous amount. By the time he died in 1703, the debt had increased to twice that amount. These debts, by the way, were not just connected with his military supplies. Because of his good credit and connections, he became the emperor's greatest and most indispensable creditor. His funds not only paid troops and purchased military supplies, he paid the expenses of the emperor's envoys to Madrid, Munich, Rome, and Hanover, the pensions of the generals and officials, princesses and royal widows, and he paid the expenses of peace treaties. And he did this all by only charging the emperor 6% interest, plus a few percent for commissions on military supplies and or exchanging currency. While the non-Jewish financiers of his time would charge the emperor between 18 and 30%. To add insult to injury, although Oppenheimer was granted the rare honor of being allowed to live in Vienna, at a time when Jews were banned from the city, in the year 1700, his stately home was plundered by a mob who broke its windows and doors, destroyed the costly furnishings of the house, and tore up or stole almost all his business papers, ledgers, and correspondence. Many of those employees of his who worked in the house were also wounded or killed. Oppenheimer and his family, however, were able to escape harm by hiding in an underground passageway. Besides the physical damage, which amounted to some 100,000 florins, there was a tremendous and irreplaceable damage caused by the destruction of Oppenheimer's business records. By the time he died, Schmuel Oppenheimer was heavily in debt, and the state not only was not willing to make good on their commitments to a man who literally saved their army and country, but countersued his estate, claiming he had falsified his records. This firm actually owed money to the state. Not willing to pay their debts, the state opened bankruptcy proceedings against Oppenheimer's firm, causing the bankruptcy of not only his firm, but all of his creditors, i.e. all those Jews who had lent him money. As a result, the descendants of the once wealthy Schmuel Oppenheimer experienced humiliating poverty, fulfillment of the prophecy of the Galgal HaChozer, the revolving wheel of fortune. During the period of his prosperity, however, Oppenheimer was a devoted philanthropist. He was able to ransom Jewish war prisoners by depositing valuable pledges of security, and he was also instrumental in having the taxes of the impoverished Prague community be reduced. Throughout his life, he always remained a deeply committed and pious Jew. included in his will to his sons, he wrote the following, quote, to carry out the business affairs of the kind and generous emperor faithfully, honestly, and sincerely as he had done. And he continued, second, it is my wish to be helpful to our brethren, the children of Israel, who are spread and scattered throughout the world. Since you have connections at court, you must take care to work diligently for the good of the community and not to be lazy in this regard. And may a thread of grace, Hutshal Chesed, descend upon you for having worked for the general good, kindness to others, whether to one or to many, or whether it be rich or poor, is no trivial matter. In contrast to Shmuel Oppenheimer, his learned nephew through marriage, Rav Shimshon or Samson Wertheimer, one of the leading court Jews of Hofjuden of his time, rarely ever became involved in the risky business of military supplies. Rav Shimshon was born in Worms in the year 1659, where his very learned father of Yosef Yozel, who was originally of the town of Wertheim, was a member of the council of the community. Rav Shimshon attended yeshiva in Worms and later in Frankfurt, Main, and always maintained a special affection for the city of Frankfurt, which he later richly endowed, on whose behalf he interceded with the emperor. Eventually, Rav Shimshon was appointed by the Austrian emperor as the official rabbi of his territories. He was declared to be the chief rabbi of Bohemia by the community of Prague and made honorary rabbi of Krakow and Worms. Many of his drushes, sermons, have been preserved, and he left a manuscript commentary to subjects of halacha, medrash, and kabbalah. After marrying Frumet Veronica, the daughter of a Rav Yitzhak Brillin of Mannheim, and the widow of Shmuel Oppenheimer's nephew, Nossen, he was brought to Vienna in the year 1684 and became employed by Shmuel Oppenheimer as the manager of his Vienna counting or banking house. His duties then primarily consisted of attending daily business conferences and maintaining direct contact with the royal court through constant interaction with government officials. It seems that Rav Shimshon was blessed with a magnetic personality, was able to deal well with people of almost any sort. He got along with the serious and fanatical Emperor Leopold I, with his highly spirited, vibrant, and secularly enlightened son and successor Joseph I, as well as Joseph's restrained, formal, and melancholy brother and successor, Charles VI, who loved Spanish ceremony, language, and etiquette. Rav Shimshon was also cautious by nature, and in contrast to his wife's uncle, Shmuel Oppenheimer, he refrained from any investment or loan that involved undue risk. Upon Oppenheimer's death in 1703, Wertheimer was appointed imperial court factor or agent and pledged to finance the army's operation in Germany, Italy, Hungary, Holland, and Belgium, and to pay the suppliers, generals, officers, and mercenaries, as well as finance the provisioning and recruiting of troops. His role, though, was strictly financial. He wasn't actually involved in acquiring and delivering supplies as Shmuel Oppenheimer had. In his position of imperial court factor, he paid the salaries of the emperor's officials and diplomatic envoys, and also settled the debts of the empress. He advanced money to various state economic ventures, redeemed the crown jewels that had been pawned, and also managed the credit operations between the Austrian government and the various German princes and bishops. Because of his tremendous talents and reputation, he was also appointed the court factor agent of the important states and territories of Saxony, the Palatinate, of Mainz and Treves, and was also involved in the business arrangement between these states and the Imperial Department of Finance. By the way, such activity, which presupposed an intimate knowledge of the financial and economic status of the various states, would have been possible for any ordinary Austrian official who normally would have not had any direct contact with these other states, not possess any personal credit. You have to realize that his credit was not just his own credit. It was the credit of all the other Jews who were willing to loan him the money. His financial services were also called upon in foreign negotiation as well. When Emperor Joseph's younger brother Charles, who was a candidate for the Spanish throne, came in conflict with the Spanish grandees and Philip, the French pretender for the throne. It was Wertheimer's credit, which he made available to Charles, that made his candidacy possible. When Charles suddenly came to the throne as the Holy Roman Emperor after the untimely death of his brother Joseph and was forced to relinquish his claims on the Spanish throne, he warmly showed his appreciation to his loyal servant Rav Shimshon by presenting him with a golden chain. This, by the way, was merely one of the many tokens of appreciation showered upon him. When Rav Shimshon Wertheimer died, there were found in his possession, which he basically put away, costly portraits of the King of Poland, the electors of Mainz, Bavaria, and the Palatinate, the Duke of Brunswick, and 10 golden chains, which the Emperors Leopold and Joseph, the Empress Amalia, and other nobles presented him. Selma Stern quoted the famous Prince Eugene of Savoy, the Emperor's most able general, in his characterization of this pre-modern era. Quote, "One could see almost everyday examples where a charming woman or a black-robed churchman or an imposingly bearded Jew decided the fate of whole nations," end quote. Seeing what had happened to Shmuel Oppenheimer, the ever-cautious Rav Shimshon Wertheimer decided to retire from his business at the height of his success, before he too would experience the quote-unquote gratitude of the Habsburgs, the rulers of the Holy Roman Empire. His oldest son, Wolf, however, was not as fortunate as his father, and the many millions of florins owed to him by the King of Bavaria was never repaid to him or to his heirs. And like other court Jews of his time, Rav Shimshon Wertheimer used his influence and wealth on behalf of his fellow Jews. In the year 1699, there broke out terrible pogroms in Germany, especially in the city of Bamberg in Bavaria. Rav Shimshon used his influence with the emperor who sent orders to all of the princes of the empire to stop the rioters and protect the Jews. In addition, on July 12, 1700, at the time of the publication of a libelous anti-Semitic work entitled Judaism Unmasked by Johann Andreas Eisenmenger, a professor of Oriental languages at the University of Heidelberg, Rav Shimshon Wertheimer wrote to the Emperor Leopold in the name of all of the Jewish communities of the empire. This libelous work would threaten not only the viability of all the Jewish communities in his realm, as anti-Semitic riots would now be inevitable, would be an inevitable outcome of these vile lies, but ultimately the stability of the empire itself. He offered, however, together with Shmuel Oppenheimer and Lehmann Behrens of Hanover, another influential court Jew, to reimburse Eisenmenger of any expenses he had incurred in his printing. Less than 2 weeks later, the Emperor Leopold ordered all of Eisenmenger's books confiscated, and it wasn't until many years later, in 1741, that Eisenmenger's heirs were allowed to publish the book. Throughout his life, Rav Shimshon was devoted in helping Jews in distress. He passed away in the year 1725. In his will, he left a fund of 150,000 florin, gold dollars, for the support of the poor in Europe, as well as 22,000 florin for the support of the poor in Eretz Yisrael. Learning Torah was the most precious thing of Shimshon Wertheimer's life. In his last will and testament, he expressed his desire that his youngest son, who is not yet married, should dedicate his life to the study of Torah, and when the time would come, he should choose as a wife a Bas Talmud Chacham, the daughter of a distinguished Torah scholar. In order that finances should not be an issue, he even set aside some 25,000 to 30,000 talers for his prospective daughter-in-law, that she would be able to provide the customary dowry for his son. The court Jew was often more than just a merchant or financier. Frequently was also a confidant of his princely employer and often a master diplomat. One court Jew who probably most embodied all of these talents and was probably the most revered of all of the court Jews was Yisachar HaLevi Berman, known to the world at large as Beren Lehman. Rabbi Marcus Lehman, the prolific author and chief rabbi of 19th century Mainz, Germany, was a direct descendant of his. Berend Lehman was born in Halberstadt in the year 1661 into a learned and pious family. As a young man, he displayed great business acumen and moved to Hanover and eventually entered into a business relationship with the chief court Jew of Hanover, Lehmann or Lippmann Behrens. Through him, Berend Lehman, don't be confused, there's two names here, right? There's Lehmann Behrens, one person, and Berend Lehman, another person. So the names are a little similar, but confusing. Through him, Berend Lehman came into close contact with a number of German princes, in particular with Frederick Augustus, the Elector of Saxony, who made Berend Lehman his official court factor agent, and a year later he made him a resident, his diplomatic representative of the Lower Saxony district. By the way, during this lecture, I've frequently mentioned the term or title elector. What this means is that the Holy Roman Emperor was chosen by vote by special electors, who also took part in the political decision-making process of the empire at the Reichstag, or Diet or Parliament in Regensburg. There are originally 8 electors: the Elector of Cologne, Trier, Mainz, Bavaria, Bohemia, the Palatinate, Saxony, and Brandenburg. Through the wealth and influence of Lehmann Behrens, the court Jew of Hanover, Ernest Augustus, the Duke of Hanover, was appointed to the powerful position of being the 9th elector. By the way, Ernest Augustus of Hanover married Sophia, the granddaughter of James I of England. Their son George eventually became George I of England. George's grandson, King George III of England, is remembered by Americans as being the villain of the American Revolution. George III's granddaughter, Victoria, eventually became Queen of England. And Victoria's great-granddaughter, Elizabeth, is presently the Queen of England. Now, Berend Lehman, the court Jew of Saxony, in a similar fashion, was able to arrange that his employer, the Elector of Saxony, be elected to the position of King of Poland. Now, the previous King of Poland, the famous liberator of Vienna from the Turks, Jan or John Sobieski — this is in Yiddish, there's a term, if you want to say that something happened a long time ago, this von Melech Sobieski's Yodim. This is the time of the King Sobieski. He died in the year 1696. Unlike other countries, the noblemen, the Pritzim of Poland, control the electoral process. There were many qualified candidates for the now vacated position, including Jan Sobieski's sons and several Polish noblemen. Right before the election, the Elector of Saxony, Frederick Augustus, who was then a Protestant, secretly converted to Catholicism, the state religion of Poland, thus securing the support of Leopold I, the Catholic and pious Holy Roman Emperor. At the same time, Frederick Augustus sent his cabinet minister, Count Fleming, who was married to a daughter of one of the Polish nobles, to Warsaw to intercede on his behalf. Berend Lehman was charged with the responsibility of raising enough money to bribe the Polish nobleman to vote in Frederick Augustus's favor. While Frederick Augustus moved his troops to the Polish border in order to back his claims by force if need be, Count Fleming and Berend Lehman traveled to Warsaw carrying 30,000 thaler in cash and a large sum in the form of banknotes. While Fleming was busy distributing monies to the lesser nobility, Lehman was busy consulting his fellow Jews, who as tax collectors and administrators for the nobility were very well informed about the intimate opinion of the nobility and which of the noblemen's votes could be bought. The night before the election, Berend Lehman, unobserved by anyone, quickly unloaded a large shipment of wine casks, and later that night, Count Fleming distributed 40,000 thalers to both the important and unimportant electors who had already been bribed with Berend Lehman's wine and brandy. The next day, Frederick Augustus was elected king over the many candidates for the position, including the surprise Count Conti, the candidate favored by the French crown. To avoid the expected opposition by the other contenders, Frederick Augustus was immediately proclaimed king by one of the bishops in attendance. Lehmann's role wasn't yet finished, as he now had to raise the hundreds of thousands of talers that Augustus had promised the powerful Polish nobility, especially to Jacob Sobieski, a son of the previous king, who switched his support to Frederick Augustus at the very last moment before the election. He also had to furnish bribes to the Polish army to suppress a planned revolt against Frederick Augustus, and most importantly, he had to raise the millions of Frederick Augustus needed for his coronation in Krakow, which superseded any previous coronation in its splendor and wealth. It's important to note that court Jews worked in tandem with their counterparts in other princely courts. And both Lehmann barons of Hanover and Baron Lehmann of Saxony were greatly helped by Shmuel Oppenheimer and Shimshon Wertheimer of Vienna. But more than just for his brilliant business and diplomatic acumen, Rabbi Yisachar HaLevi Berman, known as Baron Lehmann, is best recognized for his philanthropy and intercession on behalf of his fellow Jews. For example, a Polish prince attempted to abduct the daughter of Hirsch Korth, the son of the chief rabbi of Lemberg, and the brother-in-law of Rabbi Yaakov Yeshua Falk, the author of Tshuvas Pnei Yeshua. At the last moment, the poor girl escaped and hid in a nearby village. His father was then arrested by the nobleman for being an accessory to her escape and was threatened to be executed. Baron, when apprised of the situation, contacted Augustus, who not only stayed Rav Hirsch Korov's execution, but also set him free. Baron then brought Rav Hirsch to Halberstadt, where he was appointed its chief rabbi. Many of Baron Lehmann's philanthropic endeavors endured long after his lifetime. He built a klaus, the equivalent of a koilel, in Halberstadt, which was well furnished with a library and its own synagogue, where Talmudic scholars could spend their waking hours immersed in their studies, a place where future scholars and teachers in Israel would be educated. His only stipulation was that the Talmudic scholars of the klaus set aside to teach the more advanced students of the community, as well as give drushes, lectures to the Halberstadt community on Shabbos. The original Talmudic scholars of the klaus were imported from Poland. Rav Israel Hildesheimer, a native of Halberstadt, and the rector and founder of the Orthodox Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin at the end of the 19th century, an institution that produced many of the Orthodox rabbis and teachers of the late 19th and early 20th century Germany, was to a large extent a product of that klaus. He lived in the city, and he learned in that Beis Medrash. I mean, afterwards, of course, he had other teachers and went to other yeshivas, but he was, like, basically learned in the koilel. Baron also lent large sums of money so that a synagogue would be built for the community of Halberstadt. That magnificent structure stood for well over 200 years until it was destroyed by the Nazis on Kristallnacht on November 9th, 1938. Although he forgave the actual loan, Baron insisted the community pay 6% of that sum to pay for stipends for the scholars of the klaus. This rate was to be reduced to 5% after the year 1740. Baron also made a similar loan to the community of Berlin for the construction of the Heider-Ruther-Gasse Synagogue, one of Germany's most impressive edifices. And once again, the beneficiary of the interest of the loan was the Halberstadt Klaus, as the principal of the loan was immediately forgiven. To ensure the continuation of Torah study in Germany, Baron Lehmann undertook to print a meticulously accurate and aesthetically pleasing edition of the Talmud, as sets of the Talmud in Germany had by that time become quite rare. He presented most of the 5,000 sets that he published to Torah scholars throughout the Ashkenazic world. I would like to finish our account of Baron Lehmann with the following miraculous story, perhaps legend, from Selma Stern's The Court Jew. The spiritual heads of the bishopric of Halberstadt, it seems, found that the reversion of their land to Prussia greatly diminished their revenues. They therefore decided to rid themselves secretly of their chief creditor, the Jew layman. They sent him to a Bohemian bishop under the pretext of an important business affair, asking him to deliver a sealed letter to the bishop personally. The letter contained instructions to the bishop to put the bearer to death so that the ecclesiastic rulers of Halberstadt may have their debts wiped out. They're tzaddikim all over. Layman, however, became severely ill during the course of the journey and sent a servant ahead to deliver the message. When the servant did not return, Layman went on to Bohemia himself and learned the fate of his messenger. In conclusion, the court Jew and the important role that he played during the period between the mid-17th century and mid-18th century was a phenomenon that was unique to that particular era, the era of mercantilism and absolutism. We've only touched upon several of the most famous of these court Jews, but by and large, their genius, hard work, and piety was typical of all of the court Jews. There was one exception, however, one court Jew who was perhaps the most talented and influential, I mean, in a certain sense, of all of his colleagues, but was unique in the fact that he did not observe halacha, Jewish law. During his career as court Jew, this man didn't observe the laws of kashrus, didn't fast on Yom Kippur, lived a dissolute, immoral life similar to the aristocrats that he served. Although he didn't convert, he severed his formal religious connection to the Jewish community. His name was Yosef Zeus Oppenheimer. He was born in Heidelberg, Germany in the year 1698 and died in the city of Stuttgart, in the Duchy of Württemberg, in the year 1738. Through his hard work and latent genius, Zeus Oppenheimer became a very wealthy and influential, ultimately becoming the chief advisor and administrator to Duke Karl Alexander of Württemberg. Through Zeus Oppenheimer's efforts, Duke Karl Alexander gained control over the entire area of Württemberg at the expense of the previous local powers. This aroused this terrible enmity with the local burghers as the Jud, Jew Zeus, rather than the Duke, became the focus of their hatred. When the Duke suddenly died in March of 1737, Oppenheimer was immediately arrested by his enemies, who now seized opportunity to regain control. Oppenheimer was accused of treason for violating the Constitution of Württemberg and depriving the citizens of Württemberg of their constitutional rights. I would like to quote from page 158 of Selma Stern's work, The Court Jew, quote, "And these victors were determined to exact full vengeance for the repression that they had suffered and to stabilize their power by making an example of Zeus. Upon Zeus's arrest, his employees were also taken into custody. His home was sealed, his property confiscated, his business records and correspondence, contracts and private letters were seized. His furniture, paintings, books and valuables, his horses, carriages and wine were sold and auctioned off. All his servants, business acquaintances, and women friends were called as witnesses and subjected to long and searching interrogation," end quote. Zeus was put into chains like a common criminal and placed in a small, cold, and dark room and cruelly tormented. After almost a year of imprisonment, after a long and torturous investigation and trial, Oppenheimer was sentenced to death. In the period of his imprisonment, Yosef Zeus Oppenheimer underwent a radical change of heart and became a Baal Tshuva, a penitent. He insisted on eating only kosher food and refused all the attempts of the clergy to convert him. To quote Selma Stern again on page 262, quote, "He had once lived as a free individualist, responsible to no one. Now he became aware of the strong ties that bound him to his fellow Jews. He was less disturbed by the thought of his own death than by the fact that his death would disgrace the honorable name of his family." And he continues on. I am a Jew and will remain a Jew, he told Pastor Rieger, who attempted to convert him. I would not become a Christian even if I would become emperor. Changing one's religion is a matter for consideration by a free man. It is an evil thing for a prisoner. End quote. I would like to now quote from Selma Stern's description of Yosef Zeus Oppenheimer's final moments, taken from page 265 of her work, The Court Jews. Quote, early on Thursday, February 4th, Zeus was led into the auditorium of the city hall, where in the presence of a large number of spectators, the black-robed judges announced a verdict of death by hanging. While Zeus vehemently protested against the sentence and cried that injustice and violence were being done, the staff was broken and the cord tied about him. He was once again led back to a cell where he made known to his Jewish friends the provisions of his will. He made several bequests to his mother, brothers, and sisters, and to the Christian clergymen as a token of gratitude for their efforts. Now, just as an aside, he didn't have all of his wealth in Württemberg. As he lived, he had other estates and in other monies, other places. And I continue on. The rest of his property he left to the synagogue with the request that a memorial light be lit and prayers be said for his soul. He entreated his friend, Rabbi Mordechai Schloss, to write to all the Jewish communities that nothing evil should be said or thought about him, and to form them that he had died for the holy name of God. The Kiddush Hashem. Just before the knockers, I mean that's the executioner's cart came to take Zeus away, Victor Hoffman made a last minute attempt to convert him. And now she quotes from another work, the Yud Zeus, I guess there was a work that she's quoting from, Selma Stern. Quote, the Jew wore a scarlet coat with a small golden lace, also a jacket and trousers of the same color, a fine dress shirt without cuffs, white silk stockings, a wig and a hat without braids. You can imagine. He was going to his death in style. He continues on, as he refused to climb into the knockers, the executioner's cart, he was forcibly lifted into it by the knocker's men in chains. Knocker's men, and chains were placed on both arms and on one foot. To the right and left, the cart walked two knocker's men, one bearing a pitcher of wine and the other a beaker. The other knocker's men walked in file behind the cart. The guard consisted of grenadiers, 100 in front. These are men carrying rifles. 100 in front, 100 behind, 100 on each side, all carrying bayonets before them. 100 mounted troops of the city guard had already proceeded to the execution's place and the customary circle. On the way, the cart was stopped for a moment, and the knocker's men asked the malefactor if he wanted some wine, whereupon he answered, quote, you want to mock me? Continue on your way, end quote. When he entered the circle, he was taken from the cart in which he had been sitting by himself, and only his shoes were removed. Quote, the crowd of spectators was extremely large, since not only people from the surrounding regions had come, but even strangers from distant cities, end quote. This is taken, like, the Selma Stern is quoting from another work, and she continues on. Zeus mounted the steps of the ladder, praying in a loud voice. Over the gallows had been placed as a symbol of mockery and scorn, a red cage in which the entire locksmith's guild was supposed to have worked. In this cage, Zeus ended his life. He died uttering the words, Hero is our Shema Yisrael, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Now, although many Jews throughout the ages were given the opportunity to amass great wealth, the phenomenon of the core Jew and the immense power that he wielded was short-lived. As the absolutist governments gave way to constitutional monarchies and democracies. To a great degree, these political changes were brought about through the movement known as the Enlightenment. The philosophy of Enlightenment and its impact on the Jewish community will be the subject of the next lecture. Now, are there any questions?
It is really the Aravos added. And we know that they have to be there.
But what did the Aravos, you're asking the Aravos add?
Right.
The Aravos The fact is that the Jewish community, there's a wide spectrum in the Jewish community. There are members of the Jewish community that are not yet inspired to do good deeds, help other people, and to grow intellectually. It's those people who need help. Putting everyone together, in a sense, is the symbol of that we have to be work together as a community to uplift everyone. There's a bozel machaper al zel. This will atone, meaning will uplift and inspire the others.
And as far as, this is all Germany. In other countries, maybe in the like, they also have these court Jews. I know, like, we talked about that Barbadel was on a certain level a court Jew in his country. Were they different types of court Jews, that, or they were all the same financiers, as opposed to, shall we say, people that
You're asking about it in terms of court advisors versus financiers. This was a unique phenomenon in the Holy Roman Empire. So really, it was not, I don't believe, it was really far beyond there. We do find in England, there's one beyond this, that we do find in England at the time, there was a Jew who had tremendous influence as well. He was descended from Maranos. But during this period, this was a unique period of time. The time Barbanel was really at a different time, and a whole different. So, I mean, we've discussed during the time of in the mid 1500s, where Gracias Mendes, who was a Murano, and her son-in-law Yosef Nossi had tremendous impact in the Turkish court. But these were rare exceptions. But this was a very unique, and it was very common during this period.
What was going on with the Islamists at this particular,
What was happening with the Islamists at this time? One thing I can tell you, they were not blowing themselves up. They were impoverished. And I don't know, I'm not privy to the extent of the Jews' influence on the Ottoman Empire. And on this, I don't know. This was not part of the research. I'm not aware of the, but one thing that I do know is that generally the Jews in the Ottoman Empire was at a nadir, so to speak. There was extreme impoverishment. In the mid 1500s, it was a time of blossoming of scholarship. In the Ottoman Empire, in the time of the Beis Yosef. By the mid-1600s, we don't hear of great scholars of that thing. And from my reading, it's understood because they didn't have the wealth, really, to support this. So I don't know if Jews then were as influential there as they were in Germany in the period. But I really don't have...
Well, it's really interesting. This is just before the French Revolution.
That's right.
Courts in general there was a lot of pomp circumstance.
Right. It's interesting. Right. Is it France? The Jews virtually had no influence, though. France, the Jews were cut out. Mm-hmm. But it was only really within the Holy Roman Empire that the Jews really had all of this influence.
Although Marie Antoinette was a Habsburg.
She came from there. I mean, by the time of her, Maria Theresa, the time of her mother, Maria Theresa really hated Jews. And I don't know during her time already, this is the mid-1700s, I don't know if due to the influence that Jews had. She just personally really disliked them. That's why she exiled the Jews.
Things come in waves. Waves where the Jews become influential and then there's a crash.
Right. This is the Galgal HaChozer. This is the Wheel of Fortune. Okay, good to have.